Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Paris, France, to speak with Ben Schreiber, the Climate and Energy Program Director at Friends of the Earth, and get an appraisal of what was achieved at the recently concluded UN summit on climate change, given the complaints from well-known environmental activists like Bill McKibben and the former chief scientist at NASA, James Hansen, who has criticized the agreement as a hoax. Then we'll look into the Visa Waiver Program Improvement Act passed 407-19 by the House last week in response to the Paris attacks and the San Bernardino massacre that bars citizens with ancestry from Syria, Iraq, Sudan, or Iran from participating in the program aimed at promoting trade and tourism. Colleen Rowley, the former FBI special agent who pushed to interrogate Zacharias Moussaoui, the 13th hijacker, before the 9/11 attacks, joins us to discuss the willful blindness and double standard the blanket exclusion displays with countries like Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, and Nigeria that harbor and train terrorists not designated as ineligible for the program. Then finally, we will speak with Stephen Hill, a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. We will discuss this important new book that exposes the economic hoax of the so-called sharing economy and the big lies that companies like Uber are liberating workers and making them their own CEOs. And joining us now from Paris, France, is Ben Schreiber, the Climate and Energy Program Director at Friends of the Earth. He was previously a staff attorney at Environment America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Schreiber.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Ben, there's some mixed messages coming in terms of reviews of the agreement signed by 196 nations in Paris on Saturday. You've got Bill McKibben in it with an op-ed in the New York Times on Monday expressing his disappointment. Dr. Hansen, the former chief scientist at NASA, is describing the agreement as a fraud. How do you come down on it?
So we think that the deal clearly doesn't get us where we need to be. It's very clear that, you know, we're talking about a 3.5-degree world, way too much warming. And the United States is largely responsible for this. You know, President Obama came to Paris, and he came to Paris with a pledge that's only a fraction of what the United States' fair share is. And so the rest of the world, he told the rest of the world, we need to pick up and make up for the United States' unwillingness to do their fair share, and the rest of the world isn't getting us there by them without the U.S. doing more of a commitment.
But you're dealing with the United Nations, and the United Nations is a collection of sovereign nations, and it's almost impossible, my understanding, is to impose anything that in any way suggests an interference with national sovereignty.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, climate change is a crisis of the commons, and it's an agreement that the countries are going to have to come together and say, we're going to actually, you know, keep fossil fuels in the ground. We're going to make a commitment to each other to keep fossil fuels on the ground. And when the United States, the world's largest historical emitter, says we're not going to do our fair share, then there's not any incentive for the rest of the world to try and make up our slack. And so the United States has the opportunity to provide real leadership in these spaces. President Obama has the opportunity to provide leadership in these spaces. And instead, what he did is he tried to pass on responsibility to the rest of the world and say, you know what, we're all in this together, ignoring the fact that we're the largest cause of this problem.
Well, but are people aware that President Obama speaks for the United States in the sense that this is an executive branch deal? It's not a treaty. And the reason it's not a treaty is that we have divided government in this country. The Congress is led by Republicans, many of whom are global warming deniers and are absolutely clearly in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry and refuse to budge. And even, first of all, they won't even take the problem seriously. They don't even believe the problem exists in the first place. So the gulf between the executive branch and the Congress in this country is about as wide as you can get.
There's no question that Congress is a huge problem here in the United States, and that there are really important barriers that they're erecting to dealing with climate change. And there's no question that our political system is heavily influenced by fossil fuel companies and their massive millions of dollars that they throw into elections. But at the same time, President Obama hasn't done everything that he can to actually fight climate change. We're talking about a budget deal just this week that's going to repeal the crude oil export ban. That's not an acceptable proposal for a climate champion. We're talking about trade deals that will create new investor bills of rights for corporate polluters that allow them to sue sovereign countries when they try and keep fossil fuels in the ground. Those are not putting climate change at the forefront and recognizing how significant this problem is. And because we're not taking all of the steps that he can with his executive authority, our commitment is far less than it needs to be.
And Ben Schreiber, is this an opinion that you came across in Paris?
Most definitely. We made it very clear that we expect President Obama to do more. And civil society is doing the same thing. I think there's a huge rift, and that's why you're hearing divided opinion between, sort of big groups and the environmental justice community, the people on the ground. You know, the marches here in Paris were incredible, and they were all making it clear that civil society, people in the streets are demanding more. And I think the exciting thing that we have right now is that we've seen the success of what movements can do in this space with the Keystone XL fight. And we're seeing that we can actually force politicians to do things that they don't want to do, to take on the oil and gas industry, and that we can win.
And again, I'm speaking with Ben Schreiber, who is in Paris, France. He is the Climate and Energy Program Director at Friends of the Earth, and he previously was a staff attorney at Environment America. So is the divide then between those that are cheering the agreement and those that are skeptical, if not disappointed, between the sort of activist community and the more establishment sort of environmental groups? I mean, give us a breakdown. Friends of the Earth that you represent are skeptical. The Sierra Club, the NRDC, are they all in favor of it?
Yeah, and I think what it breaks down to is really a question of equity and whether or not we're content with just solving the problem or whether or not we realize and recognize that to solve this problem, we're going to have to do it in an equitable fashion, that we're not going to actually have a solution that basically tells the rest of the world that they can't develop. And so, you know, Friends of the Earth is part of an international network of groups all over the globe, groups that represent countries that are developing, where really they need to, use more energy. And so they're going to have to do it either with finance from the United States and the rest of the developed world, or they're going to try and use fossil fuels. And we don't have the authority to tell them to stop developing. And so we're going to help them move forward on a trajectory that's much more sustainable than the one that we took. And so, yes, this deal maybe will keep climate change, maybe is the start to something that could keep temperatures below 2 degrees. And so in that sense, it's maybe not a total failure, but it's not an agreement that will do it equitably. And so there are millions, hundreds of millions of people that are left out in the cold in this deal.
Well, but of course there are countries amongst the 196 countries that fought tooth and nail against what is in the agreement. Although Saudi Arabia has been a spoiler in the past, they eventually signed on. But Russia and Venezuela were very much against the agreement. Obviously, at the end of the day, they were somewhat overruled. So how do you factor in these resource-dependent countries that particularly are dependent upon either exporting coal, like Australia, or oil and gas, like Saudi Arabia, the Gulf countries, Venezuela, and, of course, mm-hmm. Russia?
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes those are the same countries that are banding together with the United States and trying to stall action. You know, one of the biggest sticking points in these negotiations was something called loss and damage. Whether or not the United States and other large historical emitters and polluters were going to be able to be held responsible for the damage that is already being caused to small island states, places where literally, you know, they're going to be underwater in 10 or 30 years from now. And how do we compensate those people? Can we will we compensate those people? And so it's things like that that were huge sticking points at the end. Obviously, the United States is not the sole actor in an international negotiation. But there's no question that we set the tone, especially since we are the largest historical contributor to this problem.
So I mean, who's really to blame, though, in terms of the United States? You do seem to have a president that at least is trying. You have a Congress that's totally opposed. You have a political debate where I think we're the only country on the planet that even discusses the idea climate change is not real. And you have a big constituency. For example, I think most of the Republicans running for president of the United States are either a climate change skeptics or are deniers. They have a big constituency. Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are the two leading ones in the polls, are both climate change deniers. And obviously, if a Republican becomes president of the United States in 2016, this whole deal, as far as the U.S. is concerned, will be killed. So I'm just trying to be fair here to who's trying to do the right thing and who's not, because, you know, we are in a divided country, and it's, I think one can identify those that are trying to deal with the reality of climate change and those that are either cynically in the pocket of the polluters, or two are just plain ignorant and don't are anti-science, Neanderthals.
So there is no question that there's a difference between President Obama and the Republican presidential candidates and the Senate right now and the Congress. The Congress right now is basically beholden to oil and gas companies and oil and gas money. And that's why you have, you know, the preponderance of science deniers. You have James Inhofe, you know, making an idiot of himself with a snowball on the Senate floor. You know, it's a spectacle, and it's actually, frankly, embarrassing. And it really boils down to oil and gas money and the unfair and just disproportionate impact it has on our political system. President Obama has really stepped it up on climate change in the last 3 years of his presidency. But the first 4 years, he really didn't do very much, and he wasted 4 years of time. He's also just not showing enough urgency right now for the scale of this problem, and we're going to need more from our next president. There is no way that we can do two steps forward, one step back. We need an Apollo program type of commitment to dealing with this problem, and right now we're not getting that out of either party.
But how do you bring about the change that you're talking about in terms of a people's movement, as opposed to waiting for and relying on politicians, some of whom are reactionaries, some of whom are completely antithetical to change and even don't even want to recognize the problem in the first place, and then those that do arguably... some are gutless, some are compromised, and some are doing the right thing. But in terms of a people's movement, every time I fill up my car with gasoline, I'm a part of the problem, but I don't know what else to do. I mean, short of buying an electric car or a hybrid car, which obviously we all should do, but not all of us have the money to do it. So How do you reach the average person when they're filling up the gas tank to recognize that they are, in effect, committing a crime against the future by their activity, even though they don't feel that they should be held responsible for what they're doing?
So individual choices are important, and they're really great. And we need more people to put solar panels on their roofs, and we need more people to buy electric cars. And I hope that people do make conscientious choices. But at the end of the day, I fundamentally don't believe that individual choices are going to be what gets us there. We're going to need really a massive deployment of renewable energy like we haven't seen before in decades. I mean, something like the space program, where we just replace coal-fired power plants and natural gas-fired power plants with cleaner energy sources. And so what we're talking about is government intervention. We're talking about the reality that when you and I turn on our lights, we need that power to come from solar panels, and we need that power to come from windmills. And right now, you know, we're not making that transition nearly fast enough. And that's a transition that's going to be managed by politicians. And so what we need to do is turn out to the streets, demand more from our politicians, and then at the end of the day, vote. And make sure that we're not allowing people to get free passes, either when they're climate deniers or when they're doing steps backward, like repealing the crude oil export ban, and making sure that they're hearing from us and that they know that there's a chance they're not going to be back in office if they're making bad choices like that.
Well, that's, you know, at the end of the day, that's my question is, when do we stop sleeping with the enemy? And when can we really be all allies and in this lifeboat Earth together, where you know, basically we have a, you know, we're all sort of global patriots, if you will, fighting equally for this one and only planet. That's the problem I see, that as long as we're doing what we're doing because we don't have a choice, we're sleeping with the enemy.
And I think, you know, that's a great analogy, because at the end of the day, we do have the resources to solve this problem. You know, the amount of money that we spend on military, on bombs, on the symptoms of the climate problem, they aren't actually solving the problem at all. If we put that money into climate finance, if we put that money into actually making the transition to renewable energy for our country and for the rest of the world, we would have a fighting chance to actually not only solve climate change, but to actually have a better economy at the end of the day, too. One that doesn't have people who live, you know, near coal-fired power plants having asthma and lung disease. One that doesn't have coal miners with black lung. So we can make this transition, and it would be better for everybody. It's just about choices.
Well, Ben Schreiber, I thank you very much for joining us from Paris, France. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ben Schreiber, who is in Paris, France. He is the Climate and Energy Program Director at Friends of the Earth, and he previously was a staff attorney at Environment America. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the willful blindness and double standard of the blanket exclusion with the Visa Waiver Act, where countries like Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, and Nigeria are not designated as ineligible. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent who, working out of the Minneapolis office in the 1990s, pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. In 2002, she brought some of the pre-9/11 lapses to light and testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. Time magazine named her and two other whistleblowers persons of the year, and she retired from the FBI in 2004 and now speaks publicly on ethical decision-making and balancing civil liberties with the need for effective investigations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colleen Rowley.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Colleen, in response to both the Paris attacks and the San Bernardino massacre, the House has moved to pass a visa waiver act that is pretty extraordinary when you consider that the shooter, particularly the female shooter out here in San Bernardino, was from both Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, where it's quite likely that she was radicalized in one or both of those countries, even though the FBI director says that she was radicalized over here. One, she was able to get a visa without them looking at social media, which would have revealed her radicalization. But two, and more, I think more to the point, what the Congress just passed last Tuesday seems to be, again, going after the wrong people. They're going after the Syrian, anybody from Syria, Iraq, Somalia, and Iran. But people can come from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and a whole bunch of other countries that are breeding grounds for terrorists. So what's going on with this extraordinary blindness that we have about where the terrorists are really coming from?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of answers to that. One is the visa waiver program is 30 years old. I and a co-writer actually wrote over a year ago pointing to some of the gaps and the fact that this was already after some of the attacks had begun in Europe, and they were noting that some Europeans were going down to Syria and Iraq to fight, to wage jihad with the rebels. Okay, so after that, we said, you know, this visa waiver program is very loose, and there's very little checking. And how do you know if somebody in Europe now who is one of the 38 countries could not come to the United States? Okay, after we wrote that a year ago, there was nothing. Congress did not react, of course, and they were already, you know, they should have already woken up, and then they would have had more time to delve into it, to think, to actually have committee hearings. And so one of the problems is this was a knee-jerk reaction to the San Bernardino and maybe to the Paris attacks. And they said, oh, and then there's one more piece here. This is very important. I don't think people realize this. There has always been the notion that the terrorist watch list, which is also called the Terrorist Identities Data Mart Environment, the TIDE list, which has 1.1 million people on it, not names, but 1.1 million people. And it was always this, we kind of were lulled into believing that they then would cross-check with that list and it would catch anybody who was a terrorist or was radicalized. You mentioned social media, and really I can say that the checking of social media would be very, very difficult, and they probably, we wouldn't probably be able to have anyone come here, because especially from a variety of countries, because people are posting things all the time and you can't really tell what they mean. But going back to what I was saying about cross-checking with the terrorist watch list, this was always believed that this would work. But I think what really scared Congress was they found out that at least one of the Paris attackers, and there may have been more, would not have been caught by that list. And that was even before they found out that Malik, the wife who had come in on a fiancé visa, was not on the list either. She was not on the TIDE list. And so that is very important to know, because once you realize that this massive data collection that the NSA sold, this would keep us safe and all this, and you realize that this is failing, that then you go back and you say, how can we tighten the visa waiver program itself? And because they did it in a couple of days, I think they really flubbed up here.
Well, let me just read the list of countries that aren't on this list. Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Yemen, Qatar, Kuwait, UAE, Egypt, Jordan, Libya, Nigeria, Chechnya. So that's pretty, not Chechnya's a nation, but still, that we know from the Boston attacks that it's a breeding ground for terrorists. So this is, I mean, I saw, watched Comey testify the other day before the Senate, and Lindsey Graham was asking him questions about whether these two were radicalized abroad, and particularly Tafsin Malik in both Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. And the FBI director said, no, they were radicalized over here. And then Lindsey Graham said, well, if it turned out to be there were foreign fingerprints, that would be a game changer, would it not? And the FBI director agreed that it would be a game changer. As far as I can tell, from having interviewed Pakistan's former ambassador to the U.S. and other intelligence people off the record, it doesn't seem to be much doubt that this woman was radicalized in either or both Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, and may well have had military training in either or both of those countries.
Yeah, and you know, you can have proportions of how you're self-radicalized. I think it's kind of it's very difficult to delve into that, and people want to come up with profiles, and it's not really possible because it is quite possible for people to be completely homegrown radicalized through the internet. Major Hassan in Fort Hood, there were things, lots of events that occurred with him. He was listening to stories of atrocities over in Afghanistan, etc., but there were reasons, but he then became self-radicalized. So even here in the United States, I think the countries you listed have all, I mean, partly the solution of having a blanket discrimination against people whose ancestry, they could be French citizens, they could be British citizens, Japanese, it doesn't matter, but if their ancestry was one of these four countries, and then leaving off anyone whose ancestry was Saudi Arabia or Pakistan or Yemen, and all those other countries, again, there's like a dozen or more. Even Nigeria furnished the underwear bomber. And so there are at least a dozen countries that have actually, some of the citizens of those countries have become terrorists. And so it really makes no sense. You said Somalia, but it's Sudan.
Oh, sorry.
The four countries, they, I don't know, but it's like they picked them out of a hat in some ways. Syria, Iraq, Sudan and Iran, and Iran makes no sense at all because Iran, as far as I know, there's never been a terrorist from Iran in the United States. And secondly, Iran is actually fighting the Al-Qaeda and the ISIS. They're actually the enemies. It's a little bit harkens back to how Saddam was an enemy of Al-Qaeda, and yet somehow the politicians blended him together, 9/11, you know, Iraq was behind 9/11, and the truth was exactly the opposite. Saddam was an enemy of Al-Qaeda. Iran right now is actually an enemy of the Wahhabi extremism. You know, if you want to get into the nuts and bolts of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, they are coming from this narrow, well, I don't say it's narrow, but it's kind of a perverted Wahhabi form of theology that Saudi Arabia cultivated. They were the country that started it, and now it has spread into other countries in the Mideast.
So is this, again, this peculiar blindness or double standard, whatever you want to call it, where we're punishing countries, and particularly Iran, with whom the president just made a deal? And as you correctly point out, they are the enemies of the Islamic State and of Al-Qaeda. And Sudan, which is a long-standing enemy, or at least the president is wanted by the International Criminal Court. There's nothing much been happening there for a long time. They're pretty busy with Darfur, committing genocide in Darfur and encouraging the destabilization of the new country to the south, South Sudan. And then you've got Iraq, which is a basket case largely because of what we did in breaking the country. So the reason that Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, these other countries that should be on the list, aren't on the list, my sense is it ties into what's going on with the possibility that the fingerprints of foreign training for these terrorists out of San Bernardino come from these countries too, and that they're simply keeping this information from the American people because there's nothing they can do about it. So is that what secrecy is really about, that you lie to your people, not about great government conspiracies, but you lie to your people because you don't want them to get riled up and expect you to do something about it?
I definitely agree with that last statement. I think a lot of the the propaganda and falsehood is to placate the population. You know, they saw what happened during the Vietnam War. They called it, we're going to conquer Vietnam syndrome. That was a nice way of saying it. So we're going to find ways to make the public not care enough. And unfortunately, this endangers the public when the public does not care enough to really look into things. And they trust, you know, it's natural. We would trust Congress. We would at least trust some of their staffers to know these things about Al-Qaeda terrorism. And if you're going to write a bill, you certainly don't put a country, you don't willy-nilly name, if you're going to do blanket discrimination, by the way, against four countries, you're going to be a little more careful about that than what they were. And again, the people of this country have to find out. We had an agent that testified after 9/11 that 15, and of course, it's somewhat known that 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. And there was one from Yemen, one from Egypt. I mean, some of these other countries that are also not on the visa that are not going to be excluded from the visa waiver program. And, you know, when they tried to explain some of this, they were, in fact, cut off. The other problem we have right now with covering up for Saudi Arabia are the 28 pages that were in the Joint Intelligence Committee's report that, for whatever reason, were blacked out. And it's pretty incredible that 14 years later, and there's even a demand by Congress. There's representatives and there's senators that have signed, you know, letters. There's a resolution, and yet they will not release those 28 pages. And I think they're probably not the strong. They probably don't indict Saudi Arabia, but they probably do say that, you know, the funding came to bin Laden from Saudi Arabia. I'm sure that's some of that is what they're saying. And that's incredible. They're keeping it blacked out so the public, so the American public can't know that the threat of Al-Qaeda was actually, you know, was in part due to Saudi Arabia. And the part I don't agree with what you said we can't do anything about it. That's not true at all. The first thing that you could do in government, in which the American people should demand, is to cut off the billions that are going to buy arms for Saudi Arabia right now. Saudi Arabia is like third or fourth in military arms in the world. And if, in fact, they're still messing around playing with these terrorist groups like ISIS, and, in fact, it wasn't just Al-Qaeda. There's some evidence that they were also supporting ISIS, the emerging of ISIS. That is silly for us then to be supporting Saudi Arabia with military arms. Well, in fact, we legally we shouldn't be. They're also, because of the human rights abuses and everything else, there's laws that say we can't even be doing this.
Well, I've spoken a number of times to Senator Bob Graham, the former chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who also co-chaired the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11, from which these 28 pages have been redacted and held from the public. And the senator said that the Congress people who have been able to see this by going into the basement of the where the Intelligence Committee hearing rooms are, the sealed bubble, if you will, they can go in and read these pages. They can't take any notes. They can't take any staff with them, and they can't record anything, but they can read them. And a few people, few Congress people have, including Senator Graham's daughter, who's a congresswoman. And Bob Graham told me that he said everybody that's read those pages, those 28 pages, have absolutely been blown away, that their entire perspective on what 9/11 was about has changed. So that's what he tells me. And he knows what's in the pages, but he can't talk about it.
And you know, this is a perfect example of how things would change, because if we had not, if those pages were allowed, and if our congresspersons had, who's the female representative, Miller, is it? I think, I can't remember the name of the woman who actually quickly wrote up this visa waiver improvement bill. But let's ask her. Have you read the 28 pages? Are you one of the people? And you better get over there right away and read them, because she now has drafted a bill that did not include excluding Saudi Arabia from getting easy visas without much checking to come into the United States. If she had read those pages, that may well have changed her mind. It may well have changed a lot of people's minds about arming, giving the billions of dollars of arms to Saudi Arabia. So there's concrete, when you say we can't do anything, well, there you go. If people knew the truth about this, there is a really, right from the start, there's a lot that could be done to rein this in. There's no way we're going to be able to fight ISIS if there's powerful forces out there that are supporting ISIS from the other end, and some of them even are our supposed allies.
So, I mean, obviously what I was suggesting is that this is the government's attitude, is to keep secrets from the people, because if they knew, they'd expect the government to do something. The government doesn't want to do something. But again, you know, we are a democracy, and maybe what the people want done should be done. And I think that's the case you're making, right?
Absolutely. I'm very happy that at least we're doing this interview, and I hope that the listeners will understand that it is actually their own safety. When the terrorism, when this blowback starts now to occur inside the United States, if you remember Bush, we're going to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them here. Well, I always knew that was a lie. I mean, there's always going to be blowback. And by hitting the hornet's nest, many people, including myself, warned that then we would have this blowback and we would have terrorism here. People need to understand this really is not a game. This isn't just about, bombing these foreign countries. This is actually now hurting the United States in many ways. The visa waiver program, if it is tightened, and by the way, some of the House bill is fine. They want checks through electronic verifiable passports, passports that can't be forged and can't be, you can't get fraudulent passports. That's great. So there are some things in this House bill that are okay. It's just that two or three things make no sense. And so what we need are people, and we need people to know the truth so that they then can put the appropriate pressure on their own representatives, their own elected officials, and then we can actually make some progress. The politicians will do, I think that they will do, if there's an enormous number of people that call in, they will, of course, listen. It's just that right now there's a lot of complacency, exactly for the reason you said. The government has, really tried to, cultivate kind of a propaganda line in many ways, and there's not a lot of good independent investigative reporters and good media anymore in the United States. A lot of it's owned by the same, six people or whatever. And so when you look out there, you find, and again, appalling that even our own Congress does not understand what's going on.
Well, Colleen Rowley, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Colleen Rowley, who's a former FBI special agent, who in working out of the Minneapolis FBI office in the late 1990s pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. In 2002, she brought some of the pre-9/11 lapses to light and testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. Time magazine named her and two other whistleblowers persons of the year, and she retired from the FBI in 2004 and now speaks publicly on ethical decision-making and balancing civil liberties with the need for effective investigation. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the author of the important new book, Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stephen Hill, a senior fellow with the New America Foundation and a Holzbrinck Fellow at the American Academy in Berlin. He's a veteran journalist and author of 5 books, including the internationally praised Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. And his latest book just out is Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Hill.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And all of this hype about the new sharing economy, the 1099 economy, all of this talk about how people can be independent contractors and not have to work for the man, they're out there working for themselves, is proving to be a cruel lie for those drivers for Uber and Lyft, for example. When these companies first started, drivers, now they find that they have to drive 10 to 12 hours a day to make up for the same amount of money that they once did working 6 to 8 hours. So already the Uber and Lyft drivers are being screwed. Meanwhile, Uber has about $50 billion of capitalization on the stock exchange. So to my mind, that is a real example of what's going on here. Wall Street love the company, and the workers are being screwed and belatedly waking up.
Yes, I think that's fairly accurate. I think for a lot of these sharing economy companies, they attracted a lot of attention in the early years. It seemed like especially, they got their lift, so to speak, after the 2008 economic collapse. People didn't have jobs, so suddenly these companies came along, and it seemed like it offered a way for people to make a little bit of additional money, and so that seemed like a good thing, given the rest of the economy and how it was going. But now that we've been able to look at these companies for a few years, and we can see that there's an awful lot of downsides to them, whether it's Uber or Airbnb, TaskRabbit, Upwork, a whole bunch of these companies. I mean, sure, if you don't have any job at all, it's better than sitting home on your couch with no money. But you know, when you look at Uber and you look at the environmental impacts, when you look at the labor impacts, these are not great jobs. They tend to be most of the drivers that drive for Uber last a year on the platform, and after that, they've been through several pay cuts that comes on a regular basis from Uber. Some of them have been jerked around. They cut off the platform in Los Angeles. There was hundreds of drivers recently cut off the platform because their acceptance rate was too low, because they weren't accepting short rides, because these drivers had figured out, when you factor in the cost that drivers pay use their car to drive, and then you're stuck in traffic for 15 or 20 minutes to just go a mile or two, they're not going to make any money on that ride. So they were refusing short rides. And, if you're really the CEO of your own driving business, as Uber likes to say about its partner drivers, and you can't refuse a ride where you're not going to make any money, I mean, it certainly doesn't sound like the type of job that most people are going to want to have for very long. And that's why, many people leave this platform. So in company after company, we're seeing that, and also these drivers and people who work for TaskRabbit and Upwork and these labor brokerages, they're what's called contractors. And so they don't have any safety net. They don't have any job protection. You can be let go at any moment for anything. And many people are finding it extremely frustrating to try and work for these companies. And that doesn't mean there aren't some drivers that are, doing it and making it work. But what I've found is that the longer you've been driving for Uber and the more hours per week you try to drive for this company, the less you like it. And I think that's really telling.
And the fact that you have to now work 10 to 12 hours a day to make up for what you used to make in 6 to 8 hours would indicate that the whole idea that you're an independent contractor and that you can have several gigs and have your own lifestyle and your own work at your own pace and in your own time is absolute bull, because you're not going to have any time if you work 12 hours a day shuttling people about.
Right. So, one of the big things that that Uber talks about in their platform is the flexibility. You get to drive when you want. And that's somewhat true, though, you know, as I said, drivers are being cut off the platform for refusing certain rides. So it's not completely true. And but it is, it's also the case that Uber seems to cut the driver's wages at least once a year, and they do it in two ways. One, they decrease the amount that you as a driver get per mile, but then they also increase the amount that Uber takes of each ride. When Uber first started, they were taking 5% of each fare. Now they're up to 25 to 30% of each fare, depending on the city and the particular type of service that you are contracting for. So for a lot of these drivers, you know, I mean, Uber has tried to pull people in by saying you can make, at one point, the CEO of Uber, Travis Kalanick, was saying full-time drivers make $100,000 per year. It didn't even pass the laugh test, and yet the Washington Post and other media were just reporting it uncritically because they have no data. The only data you have in all this is Uber's data, and that's like, you know, allowing the tobacco companies to pay for their own tests. And so Uber, you know, then they were saying, well, you're going to make more than taxi companies. Well, then some journalist went out and was doing some rides with different Uber drivers and asking for their pay stubs and finding that a lot of these drivers, once you subtract their cost for driving and using your own car as a business, they're not even making minimum wage. And so we're just seeing more and more examples like this of Uber drivers who are just simply feeling like, this isn't working for me, and that's why so many of them leave after driving for only a year.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Hill, who's a senior fellow with the New America Foundation and a Holzbrink fellow at the American Academy in Berlin. He's a veteran journalist and author of five books, including the internationally praised Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. And his latest book just out is Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. It does seem that a lot of the big American corporations, for the longest time, for example, Walmart, which I think it hires more people than any other American company or any other company in the world, they came up with a kind of a lie a while back where rather than call their underpaid employees, and these are people that don't get paid a sufficient wage and have to go on the public dole in order to make up for the fact that the company that employs them doesn't pay them a living wage and doesn't give them the benefits that they need that other corporations pay, for example, you know, Costco, a competitor. But so they've come up with this rubric of calling their employees associates, as though that's some kind of promotion that gives you some sort of quasi-freelance patina. And there also seems to be in the Silicon Valley world, with these libertarians like Peter Thiel being prominent gurus in the new economy, it seems to me that both the old companies like, or traditional companies like Walmart and these new companies are all coming up with all kinds of tricks, in effect, to redefine the workplace and the arrangement between employer and employee as though somehow taking care of your employees is some antiquated 19th century notion.
Yes, that's right. They're severing the relationship between employers and employees. I mean, in my book, I talk about how the relationship used to be one of a marriage where the employer and the employee both realized that they needed each other and had to work on that relationship. And that included providing training for workers because as an employer, you know, if your workers were better trained, their productivity increased, and that meant your business made more profits. But now it's just become a series of one-night stands. There's I have a quote from one of the sharing economy gurus in the book, basically saying employers want a relationship that's where they can turn workers on and off as needed, as if workers are a radio or a television that you can just turn on or off. And so this is what the relationship is drifting towards, and the sharing economy is just another plunge in that trajectory, because now the apps have made it so much easier to hire and fire people. And so it's happening in the sharing economy, but it's also happening in the traditional economy. In the book, I tell the story of a pharmaceutical company, Merck, one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world. They had a plant in Philadelphia. They sold the plant. The new owner of the plant lays off all 400 workers and then rehires all 400 workers as contractors. Because as contractors, you save 30% on your labor costs because you don't have to pay for things like health care, Social Security, Medicare. You don't even have to pay for injured worker compensation. So many of these workers get injured on the job, and they have to pay for their own medical bills, and if they're too injured to keep working, they have to pay for their own recovery until they can work again. These are the types of tactics that employers are increasingly using in order to increase what they call labor flexibility, the ability to hire and fire at will, and they're using, even, you know, for part-time workers, they're using methods like just-in-time scheduling, where they now have these algorithms that allow them to schedule so precisely that they don't even tell you what your schedule is 2 or 3 days in advance, so it's impossible to plan your own life or to get a babysitter if you need one in order to work. You're basically on call. So even in the traditional economy, the condition of work for more of these workers is really no different than in the gig economy, where you're just, you know, accepting one gig after another and have to constantly be looking for the next job. So in many ways, these two different types of economies are starting to merge in that way, and that's extremely alarming.
But Stephen Hill, it seems that the new capitalists like the Uber CEO, who appears to be another libertarian like the guy that runs Whole Foods, or otherwise known as Whole Paycheck, in what they seem to be doing, though, is they're sort of turning the customer against the employee. So, for example, everybody I talk to likes Uber because it's efficient and there's no tipping, there's no paperwork, you just get the ride, it all happens on your phone, and it's a very easy, user-friendly transaction. So it seems to me,
Ian, I think we also have to acknowledge that, you know, in many cities, probably most cities, taxi service has not been very good. So the competition that Uber has to beat, you know, it doesn't take that much because, I mean, in San Francisco where I live, it would take 35 to 40 minutes for a taxi to get to the part of the city where I live. Unless you're in the downtown core, it was really hard to get a taxi, and I'm sure that's true in Los Angeles. It's certainly true in Seattle and New York City and other places. So, you know, but the reason why was because there was a limited supply of cars. That's what the medallion system was designed for, to limit the supply of cars, which limited the congestion on our streets. Now along comes a competitor, Uber, who the Travis Kalanick's stated goal is to flood our streets with cars so that your wait is less. You hit that app and the car shows up in 10 minutes. That seems like a great convenience. But now, because of the huge increase in congestion that's happening in city after city, people in San Francisco, that's all they talk about now is how hard it is to get from point A to point B. Well, you think that, having a new service like Uber, where, you know, in San Francisco there are 15,000 Uber cars. Now, not all of them are on the street at the same time, but even if you add 2,000 or 3,000 at any one time, there goes your streets. There goes the increase in congestion. So this is a clash of conveniences. You get that car now very quickly compared to a taxi, but now you're sitting in traffic for 15 or 20 minutes longer because the congestion is going up. And this is not a surprise. We've seen this throughout the history of the taxi industry, that when there's too many cars on the streets, the amount of traffic congestion zooms through the roof. And that's exactly what's happening.
Well, I was suggesting, though, that it seems that the new capitalists are driving a wedge between the customer and the worker, so that you sort of like the convenience, the customer likes the convenience, but they don't have to consider the worker and the conditions under which they work. And that seems to be the direction that we're heading in. In other words, unless we all have solidarity amongst each other as fellow workers, we're not going to stand up for each other.
Well, and that's certainly the labor issues that are going on. I mean, with Uber, there's both environmental issues, traffic congestion, increase in carbon dioxide. You know, there goes your climate change caps that every city is supposed to be trying to fulfill. But on top of that, the labor issues, in which people are simply, you know, that's all they care about is, you know, that they get that ride from a taxi, from some sort of car very quickly. I mean, you know, driving a taxi used to be a middle-class job. A lot of taxi drivers made a decent living, put their kids through college with that. And now, sure, it's providing some jobs for Uber drivers. But in the meantime, it's undermining this other industry. And so I really think we have to start thinking more about our streets as a public utility. I mean, I think ride sharing is here to stay. It's going to be pretty hard to stuff that back in the bottle. But I think we have to think about our streets as a public utility and how to incorporate it in a way that's going to work for the drivers as workers. It's going to work for the environment. It's going to work for consumers. And right now, that kind of thought isn't happening. People are just, you know, you have one company that's dedicated to just flooding our streets with cars because they're in a war with taxi. They're cutting wages for drivers because they're in a price war with taxi as well as other ride-sharing competitors like Lyft, and they're doing it on the backs of their drivers. That's what's going on.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that you're offering up in the book. Your book's more than a critique. It talks about new policies that could remedy this new economic inequality that's being driven by this so-called sharing economy, the creation of individual security accounts to ensure that the growing numbers of workers in the so-called gig economy are taken care of. I believe that the predictions are that we're going to be, within a decade, a near majority of the 145 million Americans employed will be impacted by this so-called sharing economy.
Yes, that's right. Also, in the aftermath of the Great Recession, during this very tepid recovery, most of the jobs that have been created are not good jobs. A lot of them are part-time jobs, temp jobs. A fifth of the jobs created have been temp jobs. And so we're turning into a workforce that used to many workers for decades, you know, they had a single employer. They would work many hours per day and per week for that employer. They would get their safety net, their health care and retirement and others through that employer. But now more and more workers have multiple employers, and it's just the case that our economy was not set up for these types of workers. And so the proposal I've made in my book is to create a system of portable safety net, of portable benefits for every type of worker, whether you're a freelancer, a contractor, or even working in the traditional economy as a regular employee, where the business would pay a certain amount of money above the wage into an individual security account that's been set up for each worker, and that the amount paid would be prorated to the number of hours that you work for that business. And then that money would be used by that worker to purchase the safety net that she or he needs for themselves and their families. And, you know, you would put some of that into existing infrastructure for safety nets. So some of that would go into health care, into Medicare, into Social Security. There would be some that would go into the unemployment fund. So if you get laid off, you'd have some money to tie you over. Some would go into the injured worker fund so that if you get injured, you're not completely left on your own. And in the proposal I made, there would be enough there for every worker to have 5 days of paid sick leave and 5 days of paid vacation. We have 60 million private sector workers in the United States that don't even have access to paid sick leave. And so this would make sure that every worker would have some paid sick leave as well as a few days of paid vacation. It's not enough in my view, but I tried to have a proposal that, you know, would be fundable, because with this proposal that I've made, it would cost about $2.50 per hour above the wage for service sector workers to have that safety net as I've described it. That's not a lot of money for and, you know, employers can afford that. They can also pass some of the costs on to the consumers, and by doing this, we should be able to implement this sort of thing. This is what other countries already do in Europe and in Canada and elsewhere. We're really the outlier in how we treat our contractors and temp workers and part-timers so much differently than we treat regularly employed full-time workers.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for the work that you do. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, and it's my pleasure to join you again.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.